Welcome to Dollars and Cents, Creating Your Fulfilled Life with Nicole Romito from Private Vista. In this podcast, we draw from years of experience as well as guest specialists to help you create the life you imagine. Join us in this journey as we enlighten and empower you to align your lifestyle to help you achieve your goals with a clear picture of your future. Now, let's get to the show.
And welcome to the Dollars and Cents podcast with your host, Nicole Romito. Nicole, it's good to be with you. What have you been up to since we last spoke with you?
Oh, it's just good to be upright these days, Bill. So if we're talking in full transparent terms. So, yeah. Yeah, I'm doing great overall. We're getting, it's May 6th. It's a beautiful day in Chicago. My golf league starts later tonight. So I'm, all things are well. So beautiful. How are you doing?
Good. I don't have a golf league, but it would be a really nice thing to have. Yeah, it would be a very nice thing to have because, yes, the weather has gotten to where it's a pleasure and not a trial at this point to be on the golf course.
Exactly.
So what are we talking about today?
Yeah. So as you'll note it, and probably our listeners will, I actually set a specific date, which we normally don't do, but that is intentional. I have in studio with me today one of the portfolio managers from one of the money managers that Private Vista uses on behalf of our clients. So I'd like to welcome in Matt McLaughlin. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Nicole. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. I appreciate you taking time out of your, I know what's been very busy days for you guys lately. So appreciate you doing that.
Yeah, it has been a really interesting time. Some of the most interesting of my career. So happy to talk about it today.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to it because as I mentioned, and I know our clients know, and I think many of our longtime listeners at Private Vista, you know, we do manage money on behalf of our clients, but our role in that is helping shape the allocation model and then vetting the actual independent money managers that we use to implement the various parts of the portfolio. So to that end, let me give a little background on Matt for our listeners. In studio with me today, as I mentioned, is Matt McLaughlin. He is a portfolio specialist for Diamond Hill. He has been with them since 2023. Prior to that, he has worked with several prestigious firms. He was a vice president at Harbor Capital Advisors from 2008 to 2016. Then he moved over to William Blair, and he was with them from 2016 to 2019. And then he returned to Harbor Capital Advisors in the role of a senior vice president, regional investment consultant, and he spent 2019 to 2023 with them. He graduated from Loras College with a Bachelor of Arts in Finance and Marketing. Matt, now that we know a little bit about you professionally, do you want to share a little bit about personally where and how you spend your time when you are not helping manage the money at Harbor?
Sure, absolutely. And while I love my job, my personal passions take up a good chunk of time, and I love them as well. So I would say I'm maybe your traditional millennial, which is a little bit weird to say, given I'm in my upper 30s now. That millennials are that old.
Oof, I feel like yeah. Are you sure about that? That doesn't seem right.
Right. It seems a little weird. I feel like for the longest time the moniker millennial was meant to apply to younger people, but so I have a wife and two young kids. So my wife of now almost 10 years. We spend a lot of time together. We love to travel. We love to eat. We are very active socially. And then two young kids, a son who is almost 8 years old and a daughter who just turned 6 yesterday. So they keep us really busy. And I'd say we are just now getting out of the diaper stage and the younger kid stage and getting into the activity stage. So I'm an active coach for both of them, and we like to go. So there's always something going on in our household, and I love it. I absolutely love it.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, I can tell by the big smile on your face that it definitely fills up your cup. So I love to hear that. Well, good. Well, thanks for sharing a little bit on that. I mean, really, when I think about you having two young kids and you're actively involved with coaching their activities and certainly still want to find time to spend with your wife and I'm sure friends, I can't even imagine how you're finding time to sleep or eat, given the high level of activity we have going on in the world, you know, which is clearly and consistently impacting all parts of the market, both to the up and downside. So I do want to just reiterate for our listeners, Matt and I are together here on Tuesday, May 6th of 2025. So everything we're going to talk about, any observations or insights that Matt shares are obviously going to be based on what's going on today. And I feel like I should say it's midday here in Central Time, because a lot could go on even just while we're recording this episode. So Matt, why don't we, I know we're going to talk about a few different themes here. I'm kind of thinking, and you know, please, if you want to start off somewhere else, I mean, I know, right? We've got all this tariff talk. The Fed's going to meet tomorrow. We've certainly have a lot of earnings announcements going on. That's obviously all U.S. based. Certainly, you and I understand that there's a whole big world outside of the U.S. So I think we're going to touch on maybe some of the geopolitical issues going on. We've got those two wars that are still ongoing. And then just, you know, international markets as well certainly have been outperforming the U.S. ones here on the equity side. So I think I kind of just teed up a handful of key topics. Where would you like to start?
You know, maybe I'll just start broad. And, you know, when you're kind of teeing up those topics, it reminded me of really why I personally love my job in international, that there's never a dull moment. There's always something going on in the world, and there's always something, you know, somewhat shocking that happens. So it is so tough to consistently predict the macro. In our fund, we try to go on a bottom-up basis. So we're looking at companies more than countries. But obviously, we're not sticking our head in the sand of what's going on in the world. So I'll just start off kind of what's went on in international this year. You know, despite the stock price weakness in the U.S. markets in the first quarter, international did quite well, as you alluded to. And it was a pretty wide performance spread. Now, that was a little bit of a change.
Long time coming, right?
Yes, I don't know about you, but
we've had clients who have been like, why do we own international? What's going on? So it's nice to for you to have your time to shine.
Yeah, which is so interesting. You know, mentioned I've been in the industry for kind of 15 plus years now. And when I came in the industry, it was quite the opposite. When right. You know, coming out of 08, 09, you know, and even going back to the early 2000s, you had the China commodity super cycle. So China's kind of rise from an emerging economy into almost a developed economy today for on many metrics, but not quite classified as a developed yet. And you had people that, you know, only wanted international. And then you start to see that sea change in kind of that 08 to 2012 time period, which it's the complete opposite now. And there's a generation of investors that have forgotten that those things can change. And, you know, to be determined if they are, but we've seen pretty strong outperformance of international so far this year based on, you know, several things, some being, you know, weakness in trade talk within or trade tariffs within the U.S. and also some positive green shoots out of other parts of the world like Europe and Japan. So it's been fascinating. The daily volatility, especially coming into April after you know, Liberation Day, has been something that I haven't seen yet in my career. So it's been a really interesting time to be looking at international markets, and I'm happy to dive into really anywhere in the world you want to, or any issue you'd like to.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I feel I agree with the international, and then certainly for a lot of many of our clients are financially independent or nearing where they need to work for pay. So they have a heavier allocation to bonds, which I know we're not going to touch on really too much today, but we had those similar conversations as well, right? For years, bonds paid nothing. You know, they truly were just like the ballast of the portfolio. So I think that same generation of investors you mentioned, not on the international side on equities, we're having those conversations on the bond side. And so that kind of leads me to say, you know, oftentimes people say, well, this time is different, or asset allocation doesn't work, or I'm going to just, you know, buy the index. I feel like maybe what I'd like to kind of highlight on is, I know as you alluded to, you're more focused on the international, but obviously don't have complete blinders on. I really like the idea that you started out on the positive note of, you mentioned, hey, there are some green shoots. For our listeners, what Matt means by that, oftentimes we'll use it in our industry. And if you think about it, it is springtime. Spring's coming a little later here in Chicago. But, you know, you have your spring flowers, which are my favorite, and the buds and the bulbs are starting to poke out their green shoots out of the ground. And that means they're growing, and then they're going to bloom and flourish. So for our listeners, it is the same if you were thinking, huh, I know that from a gardening perspective, the analogy carries over into the investing world. So maybe if you want to kind of share where a little bit of, I know we're going to stay high level, we're not making any specific recommendations or anything like that, but where are you and your team seeing the green shoots, and or maybe let's start there. And then if you think about if things evolve this way, where might there be some opportunities in the near term future?
Sure. I'll kind of do just a quick walk around the world and go about that question a little bit regionally.
Great.
So let's start in Europe. And, you know, for the longest time, and rightfully so, you know, investment returns in Europe haven't been great. They have definitely not kept up with what the U.S. returns have been over the last 10 or 12 years. But what we've started to see in Europe is, you know, really, and you know, for better or for worse, from a you know, political perspective, that Europe is going to be more on their own. We've shifted here politically with the last election to, you know, let the Europeans, or try to get the Europeans to increase their defense spending and put more of the defense on their own plate. And also, the Europeans are realizing that they need to upgrade their infrastructure. They have not invested in infrastructure as much as they probably should have over the last 10 or 20 years. And the seminal moment in our view for this change in sentiment with Europe was that Germany in the first quarter passed a 1 trillion euro spending bill. Mm. About half of that was for defense, and about half of that was for infrastructure upgrades. And so we think that is likely to become more the norm with European countries. Now, Germany, for the longest time, has done a pretty good job of not spending beyond their means. So their propensity to do that spending, you know, they have room in their budget to do that. There's some other European countries that don't have as much room. So how that works itself out is yet to be seen. But along with that spending, you know, you see kind of the push for tighter integration with some of the European countries, even the UK. There's kind of more and more positive sentiment towards integrating a little bit more, or back integrating with the EU. So that's caused some optimism within Europe. In Japan, which is another big economy in the world, for about 2 years now, they've really had a push to improve their corporate governance. And what I mean in corporate governance is how money is spent by corporations in Japan. And for the longest time, and this is a broad generalization I'll make, but Japanese companies have been managed extremely conservatively. Whereas as they get money in, maybe they're not putting that money that they make into the most productive assets or productive growth areas. They may be keeping it in, you know, say in their cash balance sheet, and that's not optimal for shareholders who want that dollar spent to make more money if it's just sitting in a cash sheet. So what Japan has begun doing about a couple of years ago is really a push to improve that capital allocation, to get companies spending money on either growing the company and returning that dollar to shareholders, or, you know, paying a dividend or buying back shares. So just really trying to get the companies being a little bit more productive with the money that they're making. And that's caused some optimism in Japan, and we've already seen room for improvement there with the companies.
That's okay. So I was going to say, to summarize, what I hear you saying is really both in Germany and Japan, we're seeing a lot of government policies where they're spending more money. So get the money out into the economies versus just sitting in the bank, if you will.
Yeah. In Japan, it's become the pressures come from a little bit from the government, but it's, you know, Japanese society tends to be very kind of internally oriented, and pressure from peers, if you will, tends to have a higher weight. So,
Interesting. Okay.
About 10 years ago, the government kind of said, hey, we want companies to do this, but there hasn't been this internal kind of corporate pressure amongst Japanese companies to do it. But about 2 years ago, the Tokyo Stock Exchange essentially started publishing a list of companies that basically their stock prices were too low, to put it simply, and almost naming and shaming these companies to, hey, you need to get your stock price up. And that's what really started that internal pressure for companies to use those dollars to in their most productive ways for shareholders, and not just having it sit in a, you know, a cash account somewhere, if you will.
Okay, so we've kind of talked about that. How are we getting more cash out there, either being spent or invested to increase stock prices, or just really getting it better utilized or deployed, I think is the better term. What about, do you want to talk at all about, do we want to touch on like China or India?
Yeah, it's an international conversation.
All right, China, perfect. I feel like those are the two of the bigger players in the room, then, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely, and for two different reasons. I'll start with China. You know, China clearly they're a kind of a rival to the U.S. on multiple different aspects. China is a fierce competitor. They've done a fantastic job of growing their economy, going back, you know, 30, 40 years, embracing capitalistic aspects and bring that into their economy to improve the lives of their people. You know, for the longest time, China, they've won because they've had a lower cost of labor and really great infrastructure to implement those lower cost of labors. And they were essentially for the longest time where the world outsourced their manufacturing to. You know, we actually see that changing over the past couple of years, where not only now do they have a low cost of labor or production, technologically they are not far behind the U.S. and so they've really done a really good job with their economy and being able to be kind of that second major player throughout the world. That said, there's several aspects of China and their economy that we particularly are not we're not bullish on, or we're not in big favor of. The first of those issues is demographics. They have a very aging population. For the longest time, they had a one-child-only policy, and what that's done is left their economy in need of, you know, future workers, and not having a big force behind the current one that's aging. Consumer spending there hasn't been good since the COVID pandemic. They're trying to get the consumer to spend, but it just hasn't come back. They've got some debt issues. Their economy's essentially been built on quite a bit of debt. And all this is to mention that, you know, the risk of war with Taiwan and their objectives to eventually bring Taiwan into the Chinese system. So all those things have us somewhat negative on China. You know, turning to India, India is quite the opposite on the demographics. Is that India has the largest population in the world. They have passed China. I believe that was last year. They passed China for a number of people, and they have a much younger population. They're younger. They're motivated. They're growing pretty fast. Their economy is likely going to benefit from kind of the world shifting manufacturing away from China. And over the last 10 or 15 years, they've done a great job of deregulating the private sector. So India is a place that we are pretty optimistic about their ability to grow over the next 10 years, whereas China, I would say we're a little bit more pessimistic.
Yeah, I saw, I'm trying to think, I saw a chart about India where they were showing that I think by 2030 or 2035, really like the, they were going to have the largest class of the next up and coming consumers. So that that was really going to be able to support a lot of, when we look at kind of the more developed countries and say, well, who's going to buy all this stuff and things like that. So I find India, that's a very interesting part of the world.
Yeah. And you see it with trade negotiations too. I mean, we're obviously sitting here on May 6th and we don't have any deals yet, but the first two countries you see mentioned are Japan and India. And that's for very good reason that I think the U.S. administration wants to be friendly to India and vice versa. So I wouldn't be surprised that if we do strike a deal, that it would be with India, would be one of the first couple countries.
Okay. That is interesting. What are your thoughts on, you know, I was listening to on the way in today, you know, kind of the radio, and they were just saying that really what's going on with China. China's saying, no, we're not talking to the administration. The administration, I think it was Bassant, said, no, we are talking to them. I mean, what are, you know, I don't understand. I'm not expecting to be like, who's telling the truth, but because probably somewhere in between there. But I mean, how do we see this working out with China? Because to your point, I mean, that has been a lot of where we've offshored manufacturing, or we get a lot of less expensive parts to make the stuff over here. But, you know, to their point with your headwinds of their having an aging population, our current administration is trying to, you know, reshore or home shore, getting stuff made here. But that takes time. I mean, you can't just move a manufacturing plant and say, okay, I'm going to open it up, you know, in the middle of Oklahoma or wherever, even if they were thinking about it or want to get on board. How do you see maybe, you know, what are your thoughts on different ways how this could pan out? I won't box you into a corner and say, how do you think it will? But maybe some, maybe a couple different ways this could end up, if you will. And what type of realistic timeframes are we talking about? And how do you kind of marry up the, we want to get it back here today versus realistically, it's a 3, 5, or 7 year timeframe to do that?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a ton more to add to what your question
is,
because I think you're exactly right on everything you hit on, is that, you know, these economies have become so tightly integrated over the years that, you know, you get into this kind of almost game theory of, okay, who can handle the pain for longer. And, you know, I could see both sides of the argument where, you know, if you're China and, you know, a lot of your exports or a good chunk of your exports are going to the United States, you know, do you want a severe decline in those exports? And if you're the Chinese Communist Party, you know, you probably don't want that, right now, given where the consumer is, given where, you know, economic growth is, that's probably not ideal for you. You know, on the flip side, you have, you know, like you mentioned in the U.S. here, we've outsourced a lot of our manufacturing to China. And there's, you know, a ton of products that we use on a day-to-day basis that if, again, like you said, you know, the supply chain was reoriented to be back in the United States or other countries, that takes years. And you know, that's going to take time. And so who kind of blinks first, I'm not sure. But I think from a U.S. perspective, our objective is to get the trade deficit down. There is a perception, whether it would be right or wrong, that a trade deficit is kind of a zero-sum game for someone, or someone's winning and someone's losing. I'm not sure we share that perspective, that in a trade, someone wins and someone loses. You go back to the example that, you know, if you have two apples and I have two oranges, and I want an apple and you want an orange, and we trade, you know, no one in that trade loses. So, but for whatever reason, you know, we have that kind of that perception, and maybe rightfully so, to get jobs back to the U.S. You know, there is that objective. But, you know, that to get that trade deficit down, that seems to be the goal. And if there's a way that the countries can negotiate where maybe that deficit comes down a bit, I think for the current administration, that's probably a win, and that's definitely what they're getting at. But, you know, to be determined. I mean, it's kind of global power conflict, and it's who knows where it's going to be. It seems like it changes on a daily basis on kind of what the negotiation will be. Is there a negotiation?
Right.
It's so tough to predict.
Can we talk maybe, because there is a lot of talk about the trade deficits, and I agree. I think it, at least in the news and things like that, it's being colored as this is bad for the U.S. Can you maybe walk through for our listeners like a little bit about trade deficits? And, you know, is it like you said, you're like, it may not necessarily be good or bad, but, you know, maybe impacts to, you know, the dollar, or the deficit, or GDP or things like that. I'm just wondering if we can give a little bit. I mean, I'm sure this isn't, you know, it'd probably take hours to fully delve into, but I'm just thinking that it's just so on the news that might be helpful for our listeners.
Sure. So I'll start off with the dollar. And one of the kind of the other kind of the clear objectives of the current administration here in the U.S. is to have a cheaper U.S. dollar. And so far, or at least since the beginning of the year, it seems like that is the way it's trending, which actually is good for international stocks and international outperformance, because right. If you have the dollar going down versus the currency that you're buying the stock in, that stock, all things equal, is overseas is doing better than when the dollar is going down. But a dollar going down or a dollar being cheaper is good for exporters in the U.S. and it's good for other people or other countries coming in and buying our products. So, all things equal, that's good for kind of international trade.
Okay. You know,
why we have such a big deficit to China? I love history, and I think economic history is just fascinating. And I'll give a really kind of simple version of economic history. You know, kind of post World War II, and there's going to be a lot of generalizations here. So hang with me. But post World War II, you basically had much of the world and the manufacturing capacity in the world just decimated. You know, you had Western Europe decimated, you had Japan decimated, a lot of China was decimated. And so really the U.S. coming out of World War II was one of the only places in the world that you actually had manufacturing capacity. Now that kind of continued, and as kind of other places in the world rebuilt their economies after World War II, you know, starting in say the 60s, 70s, and 80s, especially, there were other places in the world that had to find a way to kind of compete with the U.S. and bring money into their economy, and they started to compete on price, and having lower labor costs allowed them to produce goods that we wanted here in the United States and do it cheaper. And that helped them. It provided them jobs and rebuilding their economy. And the U.S. got the benefit of having cheaper goods produced. And over time, you know, as you would expect, you do something for a long time, you get really, really good at producing cheap goods. And that's what essentially happened with China to the biggest example, but other places in Asia, such as, you know, Taiwan and South Korea and Vietnam, they got really, really good at producing cheap items or products that were less cost than here in the United States, and they got good at it, and that benefited everyone. That improved global growth, and you know, China's economy grew, and the U.S. grew because we had what we wanted. We had capital, and we were able to trade that capital for the goods that we wanted. So that's kind of why the trade deficit has gotten to the point it has.
Okay, great. Thanks. I appreciate you taking a couple minutes to explain that for our listeners.
Sure.
Trying to think, we've kind of talked about some of the themes, kind of where you're seeing some green shoots. Why don't we, I mean, I know this is just a sliver of what you think about and talk about on a daily basis. Do we want to maybe wrap up? Do we want to hit on the Ukraine war and the war in Israel? And, you know,
sure.
Okay.
Sure. We can go there. So, you know, my comments, I'll preface it with that, you know, obviously there's a huge human cost to both of those wars, and it's just sad to see and hear
terrible.
About on a daily basis. From an economic perspective, you know, if we'll start off with the Ukraine-Russia conflict, you know, when that conflict started, you essentially had a higher risk kind of just throughout the world. I mean, it's one of the first times, I think, in modern history, kind of post-World War II, where you had kind of on-the-ground conflict in Europe to that scale. So when that happens in markets, really anywhere in international markets, you know, the price of your stock or many stocks goes down, and what goes up is your risk. And so a lower price that kind of accounts for that risk. if that conflict were to, you know, be a resolution, which I can't say we have any insight on that, that would, generally speaking, be good for stocks, especially, I think, stocks in Europe, that the risk of further escalation in that would be off the table. Now, what even if that conflict resolves, you know, I mentioned earlier about Germany and defense spending, and that kind of concept of higher defense spending more broadly is applicable to the rest of Europe as well. I think that defense spending is here to stay, because I think that conflict shocked a lot of people here in the States and in Europe, that and so much so that Europe is realizing we have to spend more on defense because the risk of conflict is probably higher than we thought it was before. You know, with the war in Gaza, we haven't seen as much impact to the financial markets as what happened with Ukraine. You saw some increase in oil prices right around the conflict started, but that kind of went away fairly quickly. You know, you have the Houthis in Yemen that they say their motives for basically launching attacks on ships coming through the Red Sea is that conflict. So basically, there's not as many ships flowing through the Red Sea, which is a key shipping lane in the world. So shipping costs would likely come down if that conflict would get resolved. But I wouldn't say that's a huge thing from a, you know, stock price perspective.
From the financial markets and from an investor's perspective.
Right. So I hope they, from a human perspective, I hope they both get resolved. Yeah. But Europe is probably Europe and Ukraine is probably a bigger deal from a financial markets perspective if that would get resolution than the conflict in Gaza.
Okay. Well, why don't we wrap up with, I know you mentioned, like you said, you invest in international equities. That has been a very unloved or overlooked part of the portfolio if you're dealing with U.S. investors, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. We talk about, like you said, you guys are certainly outperforming the U.S. markets year to date here. And we even saw that kind of going into the end of last year. What would you, do you want to maybe just give either like kind of a key themes to wrap up, or if people, and again, we're not looking for recommendations or anything like that. If people, like many, we know investors have become more heavily skewed on the U.S. side, either like how could you approach looking at international, or, you know, the themes to consider.
Sure. You know, our fund and our firm in general, we're what's called value investors. So I guess the way to say that is we look for bargains.
Right.
And we think, and this has been present for a couple years, is that international is a fantastic bargain to be had right now and in the past. And, you know, it's gotten a little more expensive relative to the U.S. recently, but there's still so many bargains to be had in international. You know, I liken it to, you know, if you want to buy an organic food product, yes, you can go to Whole Foods and you can maybe pay a little bit of a premium because of the, you know, whatever reason they have higher prices. But if you can get the same product at Walmart for a cheaper price, you know, you might want to consider buying it at Walmart because you're looking for bargains. So we, on a stock by stock basis, we see that all over international markets. And for us as value investors, that gets us excited when we say, hey, there's a fantastic business over in the UK or maybe in Mexico or somewhere in the world that if there's a comparable in the US and in the US you're paying a higher price and we can get, you know, a better investment and pay a cheaper price for it overseas, then we want to do that. And we think that's the biggest positive about international, as well as, you know, as you would expect in international, there's a lot of companies that when you start to look at them, you cringe a little bit because they don't look like great companies. And there's all kinds of issues that we don't tend to run into here in the States. I won't get into, but the, you know, quote unquote quality of companies international can be a little bit lower. And that's why we really think active management is the way to go in international, and having someone that's going through the, you know, the SEC filings, that's looking at these companies, that's meeting and talking with management to make sure you're not just buying a broad basket of securities, because there's probably some really bad ones in there. Look for an active manager, and that gets us really excited to find those diamonds in other countries and say, wow, this is a really interesting business that we want to give our investors access to.
Yeah, I would agree. I know when we're talking with clients, and again, especially over the last decade plus, we tend to have more of a value approach in our or we lean towards value generally from our allocation perspective. And, you know, I know we'll say to clients like, Matt, you want to buy your car on sale. You want to buy your vacation on sale, your food on sale. Like, why does no one want to buy their investments on sale? It just like emotionally doesn't make sense. So I hear you there. And then I think the other thing that's really interesting too, and we've seen this too with international, is to kind of add on to your point, is you really need to look at the company you're buying, because even a really good company could be located in a problematic country. Now, of course, you want to, consider in like government interference and, things like that. But, we've had clients say, well, I don't want to invest in this country because, they're having all these economic problems, or they're having, government issues or things like that. And it's like, well, I hear what you're saying, but we're investing in a company, not the country. So I do think when you're looking at international, it is, you need to kind of do peel back a few more layers of that onion to understand what is the manager really buying and why. So
and I couldn't agree more. And oftentimes the little macroeconomic issues that come up, allow you to buy a great company at a great price. And so that gets us excited. Actually, on our team, we have this exercise that at the end of each year, we look for the country or the stock market of the country that performed the worst last year, and go kind of through A to Z to try and find some great companies where maybe there was, poor sentiment on the country or something happened. So it can oftentimes be a great buying opportunity when you see those short-term macroeconomic fluctuations.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think as many things in life, the devil is in the details. I will echo that there are certainly international is one part of the portfolio where we agree that active managers really do add value because there are just so many different moving parts. A lot of these companies aren't as followed by the markets and things like that. And that can translate into, like you say, hidden gems and undervalued opportunities. So,
yep. Couldn't agree more.
Well, great. Is there anything as we wrap up that you wanted to leave as a parting thought or just reiterate for our listeners?
No, I thought this was a great conversation. Thank you for having me. And, I really enjoyed myself.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate, again, I know these are certainly busy times for portfolio managers. So I appreciate you taking time out of the trading day to share a little bit of your wisdom and insights with our listeners. So thanks again.
Yeah. Thanks again for having me.
Yeah, that was an interesting conversation. And Matt, as somebody who spent a number of years actually following international markets, you both alluded to this, but I think it's worth underlining again. People, when they look overseas, tend to think and see the world as an American sees the world, and they don't realize there are huge cultural differences and which translate into very big differences in corporate governance, which is where you were talking about in Japan. I mean, to what extent or how can investors sort of sensitize themselves or make themselves aware of the fact that there is not here and there are some big differences that they need to be aware of?
Yeah, I'd say for the average person, I think you know, travel is kind of probably the easiest thing, or, you know, quote unquote easiest, that I suggested just from a, you know, fun, you know, going to other countries. But, you know, I think when you're in other countries, you really get a feel for some of the attitudes and some of the, you know, kind of perceptions of that country. So our team travels internationally quite a bit, but that's something that the average person can do, you know, take a trip to Japan, take a trip to Europe. I would highly, highly encourage that. On a day-to-day basis, it's a little bit tough, because some of the times, you know, to get that feel, it can be tougher given language barriers and access to information, which creates opportunity for us as investors that will kind of dig deep. So it is a little bit tougher on a daily, day-to-day basis to get that feel. So I'm drawing a blank on maybe an easier way to do it other than travel. But it's a very good point.
Yeah. I guess I'd probably draw the line at, you know, saying that when it comes to international, it really probably is, to Nicole's point, really good to lean on people like yourself, firms like yourself, who are actively involved and are active managers in those countries. So thank you for coming on. Absolutely. Really appreciate you being here. Nicole, in terms of people who are listening to this and maybe want to know more or want to reach out and get further information, where's the best place for them to go and who should they contact?
I would say on the Private Vista side, they can go to our website, myprivatevista.com. And on the homepage, we have a Contact Us button. You can fill out your information, reference this episode. And depending on your question, it may be me or one of the other advisors, or it might be someone from our investment team, depending on the nature of the question. I do want to just reiterate, Private Vista, we believe in diversification, asset allocation, but we leave the picking of the individual holdings to the professional managers. So just want to kind of share that distinction, that we don't have views on, you know, these are our top 10 stocks that we're looking to buy or sell. Yeah. That's why we do the due diligence and then manage the managers, if you will, on behalf of our clients. So happy to kind of talk about our investment themes and portfolio themes from that perspective. Matt, I'm going to put you on the spot here, but I'm not sure if you guys take calls from just like the outside, you know, the general investor.
No, unfortunately, we don't.
That's what I thought.
However, so. I will take this opportunity to do the shameless plug of our website, diamondhill.com, diamond-hill.com, where we do post content. You can sign up there to get emails and hear some of our content about what's going on in international markets and what has us excited.
And that's just open to the general public. You don't need to have log-on credentials or be an investor with you, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And we'll have, for our listener, we'll have links to both our websites in the show notes.
Absolutely. The other thing you can do, which is really easy right now, is if you're not a subscriber to the podcast, become one. Hit the follow button. That way, every time a new episode is released, you'll be notified. You can give it a listen. The other thing I would ask is, if you like the podcast, tell people about it, for crying out loud. Word of mouth promotion is a most welcome tool, and we would appreciate it. So until next time, I'm Bill Tucker on behalf of Nicole and everybody at My Private Vista. Thank you for taking the time to listen today. We'll catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Dollars and Cents, Creating Your Fulfilled Life with Nicole Romito, sponsored by Private Vista. Visit our website at www.myprivatevista.com or give us a call at 312-831-4370. And don't forget to click the follow button to be notified when new episodes become available. Private Vista is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. This is not an offer to buy or sell securities. No investment process is free of risk, and there is no guarantee that the investment process or the investment opportunities referenced herein will be profitable. Past performance is neither indicative nor a guarantee of future results. The investment opportunities referenced herein may not be suitable for all investors. All data or other information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable.
any opinions, news, research, analyses, prices, or other data or information contained in this presentation is provided as general market commentary and does not constitute investment advice. Private Vista and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties expressed or implied as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions, or results obtained from the use of this information. Private Vista and Hightower Advisors, LLC, assume no liability for action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to this information. The information is provided as of the date referenced. Such data and other information are subject to changes without notice. This was created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed herein are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates.